It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, America's aging transportation infrastructure is in the spotlight again after the recent tragic Amtrak accident. We'll take a look at what it could take to fix it. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news with our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky. The Joint Finance Committee had a busy, busy week as it approved a number of education proposals on Wednesday and a whole lot more. We're going to talk about what happened with the Joint Finance Committee with WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky. Noah, welcome back.
It is good to be here, Veronica, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday to you, too. So, almost exclusively this week, we're going to talk about the Joint Finance Committee because they have been very busy, very active at work on the state budget. So what happened this week?
It has been nothing short of a huge week in the state capitol. The legislature's Joint Finance Committee went along with Governor Walker on some of his budget proposals, and on some issues they went in a different direction.
Right. So we're going to start by going in chronological order, beginning with Tuesday. What happened on Tuesday?
Right. So that was their first meeting this week. And let's start with education, simply because the committee voted to make some really dramatic changes to the state's public education system. Number one, the committee restored Governor Walker's $127 million cut to K-12. So that money is going to be restored. But the schools may end up seeing something of a cut anyway, because at the same time that they restored those cuts, the JFC voted to direct more money to private voucher schools, which, according to at least one memo, would end up costing traditional public schools around $48 million.
And the committee did take other action on voucher schools, too. What happened?
Right. So speaking of vouchers, the JFC voted to increase the pool of eligible students. Right now, the statewide program is capped at 1,000 students. Under the plan passed this week, that number would increase to 1% of the student population in any one district. And looking towards the future, at least the next 10 years of this program, that cap would slowly increase until theoretically it would go away entirely in a decade. So what we're really going to see is a rapid expansion of the voucher system here in the state of Wisconsin.
And also on the table was how to rate schools. At one point, I think we were talking about letter grades, and now we're talking stars.
Right, exactly. So this is something that's been hotly debated for quite a while. You know, how do we grade schools in a way that parents and guardians can understand? The JFC approved a new rating system. There won't be any consequences attached to these ratings, but supporters say it will give parents a tool in order to compare schools. The governor wanted a grade system. The committee instead went with a five-star system. The idea of school accountability sanctions in particular, you know, it's a very controversial issue, and it looks like it won't be dealt with by the JFC at least this year. So what we're left with at least is, you know, one grading system, or I should say rating system, the parents can use to evaluate individual schools and districts.
And that wasn't all on education. There are some other odds and ends from the Joint Finance Committee. What else did we see?
On the education front, the JFC voted to allow students who are not enrolled in public school districts to, and these are like homeschooled students, for instance, this will allow them to participate in activities offered by districts, such as sports. The JFC also chose to give the Milwaukee County Executive more power over some struggling public schools in that area. They changed the licensing requirements for teachers. And last but not least, they also voted to require high school students to take the same civics test as those who are actually looking to become U.S. citizens.
Some interesting stuff. A lot coming out on education, and the story's not over yet there, so we'll be watching.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, and earlier this week, you were talking about controversial things. The Joint Finance Committee also made headlines when they voted to require drug testing for some people.
Right. So earlier this week, Republicans on the JFC voted to require drug testing for people who are getting some kind of assistance from the state. That includes unemployment insurance, Badger Care, or those who are receiving job training in the state's W-2 program, which replaced Wisconsin's welfare program. At the same time that they'll require these drug testing, the state would offer drug treatment if they were to test positive. even this, if this becomes part of the budget, you know, in a few weeks, you know, the future is still unclear for this kind of drug testing. Similar laws have been challenged in courts in other states. It's also unclear actually how much the drug treatment would actually cost the state. So a lot of question marks here, but at least an effort, at least by Republicans and the JFC, to implement some kind of drug testing for those who are receiving state assistance.
And so all that we just discussed, now that was Tuesday into early Wednesday morning, and the Joint Finance Committee at it again yesterday, and this time talking about things like senior care, Medicare. What happened yesterday?
Right. So starting with senior care, which is the state's sort of pharmaceutical program, the JFC did not go along with Governor Walker's plan to phase out senior care and move drug coverage over to Medicare Part D for seniors. That's what the governor wanted to do. Lawmakers and the JFC instead decided to maintain senior care as it is currently, which is a very popular program.
And they also touched on Badger Care.
Yes. Lawmakers also voted on Thursday to pursue putting a cap on the amount of time somebody without kids can receive Badger Care, which is what Medicaid is here in Wisconsin. They want that cap set at 4 years. Republicans on the committee say it's an effort to control Medicaid costs. Democrats said the plan puts people's health at risk. So, again, the JFC looking at putting in caps in place in order to control costs.
We're talking right now with our news guy, Noah Ovshinsky, about the latest state news in our state news roundup. This week, it's all Joint Finance Committee news, budget-related news. And the other big news out of the JFC is WEDC, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. So this is an evolving story. And let's start at the beginning. What's been going on?
Right. So WEDC is the state's really flagship jobs creating agency. And if we rewind to the beginning of this week, the Wisconsin State Journal actually reported that a senior Walker administration official a few years ago actually pushed for a loan to a company which A, was failing at the time, B, ended up never repaying the loan, and C, involved the company's president, who was a donor to Governor Walker's election campaign. This news broke at a time when WEDC was already under the microscope, already under fire, because of several critical audits that have been published. Democrats have been calling for a federal investigation into this loan. Republicans are not going that far, but they do say they are concerned by this loan and the circumstances that led to the issuing of this loan.
And the Joint Finance Committee ended up taking up WEDC this week. What did they do?
So, yeah, this is where the JFC enters this whole story. They voted to remove Governor Walker from the WEDC board. Democrats sort of seized on this and say, oh, the governor was fired. Republicans note that it was actually Walker himself who asked to be removed. And interestingly, though, lawmakers voted to keep themselves on the board, even though under Walker's original budget, those lawmakers would have been removed.
And lawmakers also voted to end WEDC's loan program.
Right. So the program, this idea of WEDC giving out loans, very controversial, especially in the last several weeks. They voted to essentially end the loan program. Governor Walker had actually called for this last week after this latest critical audit. And so this is the JFC actually officially acting on that request to really stop this kind of loans from originating from WEDC.
Now, sounds like this is not the end of the story, not really the beginning, but we're somewhere in the murky middle.
Yes, like so many things we talk about on the show. This thing is not over by a long shot. John Nygren, who very influential lawmaker who co-chairs the Joint Finance Committee, said lawmakers will revisit the state's economic development efforts later this year. It may not happen during this budget writing process, but it's going to happen later on in the session.
And I'm sure WEDC will continue to be into the news as it evolves.
Absolutely.
All right, Noah, thanks a lot for joining us.
It was good to be here. Thanks.
That was WPR's Assistant News Director, Noah Ovshinsky, covering the biggest headlines for around the state this week for our Wisconsin News Roundup. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. The recent Amtrak derailment has put the state of America's transportation infrastructure into the spotlight and raises some questions. By way of comparison, the Eurostar train can reach 200 miles an hour and carry customers from London to France in about 2 hours. It takes Amtrak 7 hours to cover a similar distance. And when it comes to roads, according to the Federal Highway Administration, 1 in 9 U.S. bridges is unsound. In terms of overall quality of infrastructure, the U.S. is ranked 25th globally. So why isn't America among the world's richest nations higher up on that list? With us now is Rod Dearden, Emeritus Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute. He provides legislative testimony on sustainable transportation issues and is regarded by many as the father of modern transit service in Silicon Valley. Rod, welcome to Central Time.
Nice to be here, Veronica.
So let's start with the question about why the U.S. is not putting more money and emphasis on its transportation infrastructure these days.
Veronica, the old saying is, that you get what you pay for. And in the United States, we haven't been paying our transportation bills since the 1950s, 60s, and 70s. We've been living on the investments of the post-World War II generations and have just been skimping ever since. Our gas tax is a fraction of the European gas tax, which is dollars per gallon, where ours is pennies per gallon. And you get what you pay for. You mentioned the high-speed train in Europe. 30 countries have high-speed trains that will make 300 kilometers, almost 200 miles per hour average speed. Every industrialized country except the United States. Our bridges are falling apart. Our highways are potholed. We have serious congestion. And we're losing the geoeconomic competition because we can't get people to work, and product to the marketplace.
Now, you mentioned that we're living off the investments of the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, suggesting that in those decades there was more investment in infrastructure here in America. What changed?
We have been increasing the gas tax periodically during that period, and we were using more gallonage. Remember, the gas tax is on a gallon of gas, not on a, it's not a sales tax on dollars, it's on gallons. Well, we're using less gasoline now because we have more economical cars. We have electric cars, and so we're using a lot less gallonage, and we haven't increased the gas tax since the early 1990s. So we're way behind in terms of revenue for transportation investments, way behind the rest of the world.
Now, you mentioned that we're behind the rest of the world, 25th on that list in terms of overall quality of infrastructure globally. How does the United States compare in terms of what offerings are there and the soundness of infrastructure?
Well, as that research shows, we're considered a third world country when it comes to overall transportation infrastructure. Our systems are falling apart. We don't have the money to even repair them, let alone expand them to meet new capacity requirements. And it's because we haven't invested in our infrastructure for decades. The last time we had a decent highway trust fund and highway infrastructure bill was in 1991. Since then, we've been treading water, and now Congress is approving a short-term extension again, with no additional increase in funding. Well, we're getting what we pay for, and we're falling behind the world in terms of competing in the international marketplace.
So let's talk about that Highway Trust Fund. As I understand it, it funds about a third of highway projects. So why is it usually operating, it seems, in the red?
Well, it's because it's funded by the gas tax, and at the federal level, the gas tax hasn't been increased significantly since the early 1990s. And it's time now. We have to have a significant increase in the gas tax, or Congress needs to show the courage to have other kinds of revenue invested in transportation. For example, cap and trade funds, which should be invested in programs to reduce global warming and climate change. Well, high-speed rail, mass transportation are fine investments for cap and trade funds, but they haven't been invested in those areas. Another investment opportunity would be the repatriation of profits of American companies held overseas. They won't bring those profits back to the United States because of corporate taxes. Well, they ought to be paying the corporate taxes, but since they won't, maybe we can reduce the corporate taxes. Let them bring those funds back and reduce tax rates and put those taxes into our transportation infrastructure. There are several good ideas, but we can't get agreement from Congress to approve a reauthorization bill for our Surface Transportation Act.
No, raising taxes is never a sure thing, not always a popular decision, even in the best of times, let alone during, you know, shaky economic recovery times. But what sort of support or resistance have you seen to maybe something as simple as raising the gas tax?
Well, remember that the gas tax, in terms of real cost, has gone way down over the last 2 decades compared to other costs. The percentage of our household investment in gas taxes is a fraction of what it was in the early 1990s or in the 1980s. So in increasing it by 10, 15 cents, which polls say the public will support if it goes to transportation infrastructure, increasing it that amount would help a tremendous amount. And it would be barely noticeable as the price of gas goes up and down by 50 cents to a dollar over a short period of time.
We're talking right now with Rod Dearden with the Mereda Transportation Institute, and we're talking about the state of infrastructure here in the United States and how the recent Amtrak accident seems to highlight the need for reinvestment in infrastructure, you know, 1 in 9 bridges unsound. What are the costs if we don't take action to improve some of the infrastructure that seems to be failing right now, Rod?
Veronica, the obvious cost that you just referred to is in human life. And there are people dead now because Amtrak did not have the money to install positive train control. They installed partly, but they didn't have enough money to complete it, and they didn't have the radio waves to carry the frequencies to stop the train. So the train was going twice the speed it should have been going through that curve. Now, it isn't an issue as to what the driver was doing. Driver obviously was doing something wrong. But the issue is that sometimes operators make mistakes. In the rest of the world, when an operator makes a mistake, positive train control takes over and corrects that mistake by not letting the train go faster than is safe in a certain circumstance. We don't have it in the United States. And that's an example of an investment that should have been accomplished a long time ago in order to protect people's life in the United States. The same thing with our bridges that are deteriorated. Same thing with the roadway systems that are not up to standard. The same thing with our transportation elements that are not being improved as technology will allow us to improve them to become even safer and carry more people without the terrible congestion we have every morning. So we're falling behind now. And unless we invest to keep up with the rest of the world, we're going to be left behind in terms of geoeconomic competition because, as Alan Greenspan told us 3 decades ago, the country that wins the geoeconomic competition is the country that gets people to work and product to the marketplace most efficiently. And we're way down now in the 30th in the world, which is way lower than the other industrialized countries.
Well, let's take that economic argument. Can you make the case that it's not just a case of needing money to spend on infrastructure, but that it helps the economy, that you have more people riding trains, you have businesses using roads and manufacturers, you have importer-exporter goods moving out of airports more efficiently? Is improving infrastructure not just good for saving lives, but is it good for the economy?
That's the point. That is absolutely the irrefutable point. As our highways, and it's worse in the areas that have good commercial viability, like Silicon Valley or Chicago or Los Angeles or New York. Those areas are facing what's called terminal gridlock now, because their commuter traffic's meeting in the middle of the day, and you just can't get to work anymore in a reliable period of time. Now, those areas need to have alternatives. They need to have the bottleneck removed on their highway system, and they need to have their mass transportation systems and freight railroads improved so that they can move people and product more efficiently. But we're not doing it. Congress has to take the load there. They have to shoulder the primary load there, and they have to pass a reauthorization bill for the Surface Transportation Act. They haven't done that in many, many years. It has to be done now, or we will fall out of the first tier of countries in terms of economic viability in the world. We talk about China beating us. China has beaten us. They're going to leave us in the dust.
And we leave it there. Rod, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Veronica. Thanks for taking up the issue. It's terribly important.
That was Rod Dearden, Emeritus Executive Director of the Mineta Transportation Institute. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. The number of suicides in Wisconsin has been on the rise in recent years. There's also a higher number of suicides in Wisconsin than the national average. While no one really knows for sure what's behind these numbers in the state, some communities are hard at work on prevention and suicide awareness. Rhonda Brown is here with us to talk about suicide and suicide prevention in Wisconsin. She's the Division Director of 3D Community Health for HSHS Sacred Heart and St. Joseph Hospitals. Rhonda, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Well, as we just mentioned, the number of suicides has been going up over the last few years in Wisconsin. Do we have a handle on why?
Well, we don't. It really depends on who you ask. One of the difficulties that we have where looking at trends and things like that with suicide is that the statistics vary some. But we do know that we've had an economic downturn over the last several years, and we have seen an increase when people are, losing jobs and have their income turned upside down, particularly with, the middle-aged man who's tend to be the breadwinner in many of our homes. Change in income is very difficult for people to manage. We know that people that are that have major life crises, things like that, really do impact the number of suicides that we're seeing.
And there are also reports that Wisconsin has a higher suicide rate than the national average. What do you make of that? Wisconsin being higher than the nation's average?
Well, Wisconsin's suicide rate has continued to rise and exceeds those of not only the nation but of our neighboring states as well, and has remained higher than our national rate for about a decade. And some of that, again, it's difficult to know, but some of that may be equated to limited access to treatment. We have a problem with not having enough psychiatrists and psychologists and those that are in that mental health field. But when you're rural, that is even a higher issue. Of course, if you're rural, there's transportation issues. People are more isolated. They're less likely to be able to receive treatment or even be involved with others. And we know relationships and connections to others is huge in combating suicidal ideology.
What are the hurdles that you see to getting treatment in rural areas?
Well, in rural areas tend to have a little bit more difficulty in being able to recruit physicians or psychiatrists, psychologists, than some of our cities. And transportation always seems to be an issue. That comes up time and time again whenever we're doing our community health needs assessments, you know, and not just around mental health issues, but around, you know, just good physical health in general, is that people have difficulty getting to and from those clinics. Some of our rural areas don't have clinics, where other bigger cities, you know, you're more apt to be able to be close to a clinic. So we think that transportation is part of it, and, you know, again, just people being generally more isolated, it can be a component as well.
We also know that Wisconsin has what is sometimes a troubled relationship with alcohol consumption. Is there a link that you see between alcohol or substance abuse and suicide?
Oh, absolutely. We know that we tend to have a higher rate of binge drinking than a lot of other states. And people who tend to have mental health issues are often have dual diagnoses, where they are also having difficulties with self-medicating, with alcohol, with other substances, and that puts them at risk. So for sure, what we have seen is that somebody who is consuming alcohol, that puts them at risk at any level for suicide.
Does that mean that suicide prevention programs would be best served to work in tandem with alcohol treatment programs?
I think it's best for them to work in not only tandem with the treatment programs, but also in tandem with prevention initiatives. So if you're looking at mental prevention initiatives around mental health, it would behoove you to also look at prevention around alcohol and other drug abuse.
And we were talking earlier about who's most affected by suicide, and it seems to be right now middle-aged men, maybe because of the economic downturn, changes in circumstance because of income. Is that a change? I would have thought initially that those most vulnerable for suicide would have been younger people, maybe people at the mercy of more hormonal swings and sort of what you associate with youth problems.
I think most of us have thought that teens are probably the group that is most at risk, but that's really not the case and hasn't been the case. But those are the ones that we hear about probably more than others, and they're the ones that, of course, it's a young person, often a young, healthy person, and we think about, you know, they've got just so much to live for, and how can they be that hopeless? But really, the highest group, especially, you know, nationally, if you look at national statistics, the highest group is white males that are 65 and older. They have the highest rate of suicide. But around, you know, in Wisconsin and certainly in our area, in Eau Claire and the Chippewa Falls or Chippewa Valley area, we've seen that the middle-aged man is the one that is most at risk. They individuals that are 35 to 54 tend to have the greatest number of hospitalizations and emergency department visits for self-inflicted injuries. So we know that group is really at high risk, as well as veterans. Veterans accounted for one out of every five suicides in Wisconsin. So our vets are also a high-risk category.
We're talking to community health expert Rhonda Brown about suicide and suicide prevention in Wisconsin. As the numbers of suicides in Wisconsin creep up over the last 3 years, and Wisconsin is above at this point the national average for suicide. And Rhonda, we've been talking about some of the possible causes as to why people commit suicide, but is anything being done to collect more information, to get more solid data on this?
Well, for one thing, in our Chippewa Valley area, what we have done is developed in each county, so Eau Claire County and Chippewa County, we've developed what we're titling suicide death review teams. And our teams are, you know, very selected, small amount of individuals who are certainly going to keep the information confidential, but we are looking for trends. There's not a lot of data. There's being more and more research done all the time around suicidology, but we're looking at each suicide death and trying to find, are there geographic trends? You know, is there one certain area in our county that tends to have more suicides than another? You know, are we similar to the state and national, where it's a certain group, and is it men more, and also looking at, so we're looking at ages and then also type of method of suicide. So we're doing quite a lot, but there is evidence out there that says that prevention and just really reducing the stigma around mental health in general is very effective in reducing suicide. And we're also using an evidence-based program called QPR, Question, Persuade, and Refer. And we're really trying to blanket our area with QPR, and that is training individuals in the community to be able to notice that someone might be having some mental health issues, to be able to particularly ask them, you know, are you suicidal? Persuade them to get some help, and then to help them with that referral so that they get the help that they need. So there are some you know, good programs out there that we know are evidence-based and are working. And so hopefully we'll have, you know, a lot better data in the, you know, in the coming years.
Now, you talked about the stigma surrounding suicide, and this is the stigma that we often talk about when we associate, talk about mental illness as well. With suicide, what particular forms do you see that stigma taking when it comes to people getting help?
People tend to not want to talk about their feelings, and in fact, we know that you know, we tend to, particularly in the Midwest, you know, we have a hard time even identifying our feelings and knowing, you know, are we mad, or are we really sad, or are we you know, sad, or are we really afraid? So just in general, feeling identification seems to be difficult for a lot of us. And then we still kind of hold to that same old mantra of, you know, be manly, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And so for men, it's really difficult for them to seek help because they are still feeling like, you know, I shouldn't be talking about my feelings, and I should need help. I should be able to handle this on my own. So it's kind of that, in Wisconsin, that Midwestern attitude that we have. So that's one of the things that we really need to work on. Mental health in particular, you know, we just don't talk about it. I talk about suicide as being kind of the other S word, you know. People just don't feel like they should even mention it. So I think there's a lot of things that we can do to change that stigma, but it's definitely a factor.
Do you really think there is such a thing as Midwest reticence that makes us less likely to know what we're feeling and to talk about it?
I do. Our research that we've been doing shows that, like I said, particularly with men, and we hear it all the time, that, you know, people just don't really know how to talk about their feelings, and it's kind of a taboo thing still. You know, it's getting better. It's definitely getting better. And the more information and education, you know, community awareness that we can do out there, the better, and the more likely that people are going to feel more comfortable. We've been doing a lot in the Chippewa Valley around just feeling identification and encouraging people to do the really simple things, like, you know, just smile at somebody when you see them. And that sounds very elementary, but it is, and it should be. It doesn't need to be anything really extravagant to make a difference for somebody.
We're talking right now to community health expert Rhonda Brown about suicide and suicide prevention in Wisconsin, and we're taking your calls on this. Has suicide touched your life? Do you know someone who has struggled with feelings of suicide, and how do you support them? If you've ever been suicidal yourself, what kind of help did you want from your friends, your family, from the professionals that you work with? And what do you think about this number in Wisconsin going up? Is there something to this idea that here in the Midwest, we don't know how to talk about our feelings, and that's part of the problem? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation and get to your calls in just a minute. Right now, a check of the headlines with Kristen Durst from WPR News. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're picking up our discussion now with community health expert Rhonda Brown. She's with us talking about suicide and suicide prevention efforts here in Wisconsin. And we're taking your calls on this. Have you been close to someone with suicide, suicidal thoughts maybe, and what did you do to help support them? How has suicide touched your life, and why do you think the number of suicides in Wisconsin has been on the uptick in recent years? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go now to Mark. Mark joins us from Wausau. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
Hi, you know, I've experienced feelings of suicide before, and I feel like what keeps me from going in and getting help during those times is that I don't want to lose that as an option. You know, feeling ways of having suicidal thoughts, it feels like the easiest or at least a viable option. So at that time, I just don't feel like I want to lose it. And then once I'm over that hump and I'm no longer feeling that way, then I don't feel like I need to get help anymore.
Okay, so you're saying you don't go to get help because you want to keep suicide open as an option, and then when you feel better, you don't feel like you need help. Am I reading you right?
That's right. You know, I mean, I know that you would or want to seek help beyond that, but at that time it feels like almost like a waste.
Sure, I understand.
You know what I mean?
Thank you, Mark. Thank you for sharing that and for sharing that with everybody, because it's the sort of thing it's important for people to hear. And Rhonda, what would you say to Mark? He's got sort of a double bind going on when he thinks about getting help. It's sort of a push and pull thing for him.
Boy, you know, there's all sorts of feelings that go with thinking about suicide, and you know, for it is an option. It's not a good option, and we'd like to say it's never the right option. And the thing that would worry me the most is that at some point, even, you know, where you're thinking about not wanting to lose it as an option, but at some point, if you don't rebound from those feelings, then that becomes that may become an option that you follow through with, and we certainly don't want that to happen. And I understand that when you're you know, when you're feeling better, you're less likely to go for help, and I think that's true for most of us. But hopefully, at that point, you can be a little bit more rational in deciding that, you know what, I don't want that as my option. I want to be able to give that up, or at least to be able to talk to somebody about, you know, why do I think that's an option? Maybe just to get a few answers might help steer you in the right direction.
And for Mark to go in, maybe he has not gone in before to get the help and doesn't know what to expect. What should he expect if he reaches out to a healthcare professional?
Well, we usually tell people that the first place to reach out is to your own physician. So a doctor that you have a relationship with already makes it a little less intimidating to, you know, enter that whole world that may be different than just, you know, what you're used to. But also being able to just make that phone call to one of the suicide prevention crisis lines. And then, you know, you don't even have to go in at that point. If you make the call, you at least can talk to somebody without having to make that step of actually going in. And then once you do that, hopefully you'll feel a little bit more empowered to be able to actually, you know, take that step to go in and see a professional.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that, Mark, and wishing you all the best with that.
Good luck, Mark.
We're going to go next to Michelle. Michelle joins us in Door County. Hi, Michelle.
Hi.
Hi. What is your experience with suicide?
Well, unfortunately, I've had several experiences. First one, when I was 15, a good friend of mine committed suicide, and I was one of the last couple of people to see him alive. And then in my 30s, a cousin committed suicide, and I myself have experienced the feelings of suicidality. So I've seen it from both sides.
And I'm sorry to hear that.
I'm sorry to hear that too, Michelle. And have you reached out for help yourself when you felt that, having been exposed to suicide in your past?
Well, I think that I part of the it's kind of a nasty catch-22. There's a lot of guilt and confusion over having experienced the death of a friend from suicide. So it sort of added to my own bad feelings and self-esteem issues and all that stuff. But as far as reaching out and feeling better, I struggled for years and years, and the thing that helped me most was when I finally got to a point where I started to look at the depression, which does creep in, especially during the winter in Wisconsin when it's gray and awful. I look at it as it's mental illness just like a physical illness. So I compare it to diabetes when I talk to someone. So you when you talk to someone who has diabetes, you don't look down on them because they happen to have this disease. But I think there still is that stigma where if someone says they have depression, they're looked down upon. So that makes it difficult. But for myself, when I have those feelings creeping in, I can now remind myself that it's just this illness kicking in. It isn't me. I need to just ride the wave, and eventually it will pass. And for me personally, that has been the most helpful way to cope with the feelings that I have.
Are there some specific things that you do when you feel that creeping in and you know that it's the illness and you ride the wave? Are there some specific things you found that you do that make a difference for you, you know, especially in Wisconsin when, you know, most of us have some of those feelings when we've had these long, horrible winters?
Right. I have developed what I call my toolkit. There's a lot of things. There's no one solution. I am on some medications, you know, that help me just stabilize moods in general, although I am weaning off of those and doing fine. But other than that, get as much sun as possible, take vitamin D during the winter, making myself get outside, even if just for a few minutes a day, every day, does help. And I hate to say it, but lowering expectations on myself where I feel that I should go out for a half-hour walk, but when you're depressed, that is just too much. So I've gotten to a point where I'm okay. If I just get outside for 5 minutes, I'm okay, and I just have to accept that. So, you know, the physical movement, taking care of myself, getting enough sleep, eating healthy, all the typical stuff that you hear about, it's no one solution. You have to do all of it. And I think it's a little bit different for every person. You have to be able to kind of customize it for what you personally need.
Michelle, thank you so much for sharing your experience. And what about those techniques that Michelle has dealing with baseline depression so that it doesn't become suicidal thought?
She is just right on target. Congratulations for being able to you know, think this through and think about it as a illness. And that's, you know, one of the things that we're really striving for is that people will start to look at and treat mental illness no differently than physical illness. You can't have good physical health if you have poor mental health. And, in the past, we've separated the two. A lot of times we don't even have our mental health services in the same building as our hospitals, and that has just really segregated things. But she's got really good, simple techniques that she used that we would recommend. One is, you know, talking to other people, reaching out to other people, the vitamin D and getting some sun and getting outside, lowering your expectations on yourself. Those are all really, really good things that we know do make a difference for people.
And Rhonda, as we wrap up, can you leave us with some advice, either for people struggling with suicidal thoughts right now or for people who want to support someone? Where are places they can go to get help and some baseline things they can do to take care of themselves?
I would say that there are a lot of good services out there, and there's crisis hotlines there. You know, we have Ellie Phillips Libertas Treatment Center, you know, here in the Chippewa Valley area. You know, I know statewide, nationally, there are some really good services, so people can get treatment that they need. But also, I would say to everyone, there are super, super simple, like I had said earlier, things that we can all do that can make a difference for people who are struggling. And that may just be letting them know they're not invisible. Smile when you see somebody. Pay attention to the people around you and how they seem. And try to feel comfortable approaching and talking to them, or at least just, you know, acknowledging that they're there.
And we leave it there. Rhonda, thank you so much for joining us today and talking about this.
Thank you for the opportunity. I appreciate it.
That was Rhonda Brown, Division Director of 3D Community Health for HSHS Sacred Heart and St. Joseph Hospitals. She was with us to talk about suicide and suicide prevention in Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is off today. News is next on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.